I will take this case under advisement. We'll go on to the next case, which is 013188, Stephen Bosseed versus the INS.
May it please the court. Good morning. Therese King and James Basso on behalf of the petitioner, Stephen Bosseed. Your Honor, there is no dispute that aliens are entitled to due process in immigration proceedings. Mr. Bosseed's right to due process was violated in two distinct regards in the proceedings below. First, by the Board of Immigration Appeals' failure to rely on reasonable, substantial, and probative evidence in finding that he had been convicted of a particularly serious crime in 1993. And second, by his counsel's failure to provide effective assistance of counsel throughout the proceedings below. Correcting these errors will affect the outcome of Mr. Bosseed's case. Therefore, we respectfully request that the court remand the case to the Board of Immigration Appeals for a determination of whether Mr. Bosseed is entitled to withholding of relief under 8 U.S.C. Section 1231 or relief under the Convention Against Torture.
So you're focusing on the withholding of relief point at this time and relying on the fact that the immigration judge didn't think the theft offense was, quote, particularly serious, right? Because it counts as an aggravated felony, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So could you clarify, I mean, we have this debate between you and the Immigration and Naturalization Service about whether we ought to take judicial notice of this later document from the Circuit Court of Cook County that seems to indicate that they were mistaken about the intent to distribute aspect of the 93 Convention.
Well, Your Honor, this court has held that a petitioner must show by concrete evidence that he has been prejudiced by due process violations below. And without introducing this certified statement of conviction, which is a state record certified by the clerk of the court, we would not have had concrete evidence to show that he was prejudiced by these procedures below.
So it's functionally your proffer on the prejudice point.
And
you tried to get the BIA to reopen on this ground, didn't you, and they refused to?
Your Honor, Mr. Bosseed represented himself pro se in front of the BIA, and he did try to get a reopen on this issue. Unfortunately, he didn't introduce the proper conviction sheet to the BIA, so the BIA never saw the conviction sheet which we've proffered to the court. But even if the court does not look at this conviction sheet which we have proffered, the conviction sheet relied upon by the immigration judge was facially invalid. The conviction cover sheet it showed only the charges initially brought against Mr. Bosseed and the time that he was sentenced to serve for those crimes. In 1993, under the Illinois Criminal Code, a felony of Class 2, which is what possession with intent to deliver is, required a minimum sentence of 3 years. The conviction cover sheet showed, however, that Mr. Bosseed had been sentenced to only 2 years, which is consistent with a Class 4 felony or simple possession. So even if the court does not want to consider the additional evidence we have introduced on appeal, it's still evident from looking only at the evidence in front of the Board of Immigration that it did not rely on substantial evidence in making its findings. Furthermore, it's simply unfair given the immigration judge's comments throughout the proceeding below. Mr. Bosseed testified on oath that he had not been convicted of possession with intent to deliver, but rather the charges against him had been amended. The immigration judge said, quote, "So where you have other evidence that challenges the case sheet, the question is, has the service proven by clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence?" The immigration judge went further to instruct the government to go back and get the docket sheet to see if the charges had ever been amended. The government never did that. The government never introduced any other evidence, even though the immigration judge expressly withheld findings on whether he was entitled to be deported on the 1993 charge. despite these things on the record, which the immigration judge clearly said, the judge nevertheless found that he had been convicted of possession with intent to deliver in 1993. And there's simply no evidence in the record to support that contention. Furthermore, this contention was not harmless because, as the BIA and the immigration judge noted, the 2000 conviction was not a particularly serious crime. This possession with intent to deliver charge was a drug trafficking crime, as the BIA determined. And because it was a drug trafficking crime, the BIA determined that Mr. Bosetti was a threat to society.
What about the Immigration Service's argument that as a second, even if it's, we think of it as a simple possession, it was his second one, right?
The 1993 was the first one.
Okay, well then there's another one. Yeah, the 95?
Yes, John, yeah. There are three problems with the government's argument on that point, which the Third Circuit has gone through similar arguments in its recent case of Steele. The three problems are that, first, the argument is contrary to the plain language of the immigration statute, which defines an aggravated felony as an illicit trafficking crime or a drug trafficking crime. The Third Circuit has held that in order for there to be an illicit trafficking crime, there has to be some element of merchant nature or selling element. Therefore, two simple possession charges, by their very nature, are not illicit trafficking crimes. In addition, it subjects an alien to deportation based on crimes that he was not convicted of, rather simply crimes that he could have been convicted of. What the government is doing is making a patchwork quilt of the different definition sections of the Controlled Substance Act in order to shoehorn Mr. Bosetti's two simple possession charges into a felony under the CSA. And third, it leads to inconsistent results in the federal immigration law. The government's argument essentially is that as long as a conviction is a felony under state law, the conviction may be a felony under the CSA. Therefore, if two states, as the Third Circuit recognized, if two states treat the same action separately, one as a misdemeanor and one as a felony, an alien would be deported in one instance and not deported in another. This is totally contrary to our policy of having a uniform immigration law. Going back to the initial point, this error was not only not harmless in that the error led to the Board of Immigration's determination that he was statutorily barred from withholding, but it overshadowed the Board of Immigration Appeals' determinations on other issues, such as whether he was entitled to withholding. A similar case was found in Mantour versus the United States. I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time, but briefly, on the second point, he was also prejudiced for failure of his counsel to provide effective assistance during the proceedings below. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. King. And Ms. Schwartz. Oh, dear.
May it please the Court, Nora Ospoli Schwartz for Respondent John Ashcroft. Before we can reach the merits, there are several jurisdictional arguments that petitioner has to overcome, and he can't. First of all, as a criminal alien, he does not get judicial review unless there is a substantial constitutional issue presented. This Court and the Supreme Court have ruled that there is no absolute constitutional right to counsel in civil proceedings, including civil removal and deportation proceedings. This is such a case. If there is no constitutional right to counsel, then it cannot be a substantial constitutional issue.
But putting to one side, I mean, we've had a lot of things to say about the lack or extremely limited scope, as the case may be, of counsel. But due process, of course, is an issue. And we've always used examples of, you know, well, what if it's the wrong person, or what if decision is tainted because you thought that there was a conviction of an aggravated felony and there wasn't, as a matter of fact. And people do have a right to be to have correct identification and to have the INS decide on the basis of information that's really there.
Absolutely.
I take it that you're not asserting the right just to go grab somebody off the street and say, we've decided that you've been convicted of two drug crimes, out you go, when that individual had not, in fact.
But that hasn't happened here, Your Honor. What
but
we
the intent to distribute mm-hmm. element is wrong.
Well, Your Honor, on the record before the board decision was correct. Now, we have two steps beyond the hearing.
Petitioner was not coming to this court represented by counsel. He appealed to the board, and he was pro se. He moved to reopen, and he was pro se. He had two chances to correct the record when he was pro se. How can you claim that ineffective assistance of counsel when you don't have an attorney?
I'm not talking about ineffective assistance of counsel. Can you stand here right now and tell me today that Mr. Bossetti in 1993 was convicted of possession with intent to distribute?
I don't think it's clear on the record before the board, yes.
No, however, I'm not talking about the record before the board. I'm talking about the document that's been proffered to us by way of showing what would happen if there were further proceedings. What would be before the board if it were asked to reconsider withholding of removal?
Well, Your
Honor,
because
of course we don't let people even get to first base if they can't tell us that it wouldn't make a difference.
Of course, Your Honor. However, he has to exhaust his administrative remedies on that issue, and the way he does it in order to get to this court is he has to present it to the board through a motion to reopen or go to the district director.
All right. Just bottom line, as a factual matter, was the full certified statement of conviction on the 1993 charge submitted to the BIA?
Well, Your Honor, what we have at page 566 is a certified document indicating that he was charged with possession of a controlled substance. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that's the other conviction. But I would like to point out that in his motion to reopen...
Well, okay, go back to the question.
Yes, what we have here is a 1993 conviction document, certified statement of conviction disposition, certified by the clerk of the court. Page 567 of the administrative record that shows possession with intent within a school ground, not just possession with intent to distribute, but within the area of a school ground, and that was, and then a second charge of possession with intent of any amount, and it shows that he was found guilty on the possession with intent of any amount, and the other charge he was found not guilty, and he was sentenced to 2 years in jail.
So it gets an impossible sentence. That's what it shows then.
Judges have discretion, Your Honor.
No, they don't. Not when there's a statutory minimum. You should check the law on that one.
Well, you're right. But what we have here, again, before the board, is that he was convicted for trafficking and sentenced to 2 years.
And you're now conceding that that's probably wrong. And I guess my concern is, how much do we hold people to a concededly wrong piece of background information? What would harm would there be in asking the board to reconsider on the basis of an accurate record?
There is no harm, but he has to do it. I mean, how many bites at the apple does a pro se alien get? He had representation, may have been ineffective. We don't get to that point.
He tried to tell the board, though. He tried to tell the immigration judge, and the immigration judge dropped the ball, and instead of holding the board to its burden of proof, decided to do nothing.
But when he went to the board, that was his opportunity to correct the record, wasn't it? But he didn't do it.
Both the IJ and the BIA were heavily influenced by a totally erroneous belief.
Your Honor.
That he had been, you know, convicted of possession with an intent to deliver. And how we can say that such an error is not prejudicial when both the BIA and the IJ were willing to find that possession alone was not sufficient to bar relief. Who knows what they would have done if they themselves were not in error.
There are several answers to that, and there are several levels to that. First of all, he had the two opportunities to present. If he's contesting this, it is his burden to say, no, wait a minute, that isn't so. Come on, we've all dealt with criminal aliens who say, no, I didn't really do that, or I wasn't really convicted of that. There was a finding that he was. When he's on appeal to the board, he's shown that he can go to the courthouse to get a conviction document.
They're looking at a statement that has only a misleading part. They're looking at a document. The IJ is looking at a document that is totally misleading and relying on this utterly misleading document. And then the BIA compounds that by relying on the same totally misleading document.
But, Your Honor, first of all, the reason, and I know it sets up red flags when you say it's harmless, but the bottom line is it is harmless because when he went back to court, he's shown that he can go back to court and get conviction documents when he's pro se. He brought evidence of a third, of a fourth conviction and a third drug-related offense. Each one of them has been a felony. If you read the statute Gerbrier or Amaral or every circuit court to address this, and you know, we went to great lengths reading all the statutes together, when you have three felony drug-related offenses under the immigration law, you do have an aggravated felony and it constitutes a drug trafficking crime. Therefore, the analysis that the board entered into doesn't change. We are talking about he has presented to the board evidence of three drug-related felony convictions, felonies under federal or state law.
Forgive me, but has the Seventh Circuit ever taken
no.
the position that you propose that any felony criminalized under the Controlled Substances Act is a drug trafficking crime?
No, Your Honor, but it's not any felony that we're looking at. We're looking at three drug-related felonies.
Well, has the Seventh Circuit ever taken the position that three felonies criminalized under the Controlled Substances Act are drug trafficking crimes?
Well, the government would
cite any Seventh Circuit law.
No, there is none. And the government would invite this court to read the statute, read the Controlled Substances Act, the INA, all the sections that are cited in our brief and in Amaral and in Gerbier. And I think the conclusion is inescapable. When you have three drug-related felony convictions punishable as felonies under state and federal law, yes, they become drug trafficking, hypothetically. There doesn't have to be a trafficking element under the INA, under the Controlled Substances Act. You don't need to have the trafficking element. You do need to have the recidivism. And that's what we have here, clearly. Plus, in fact, I do have to correct 2 points. When he went to reopen before the board, it was not for the purpose of this conviction, although he had two opportunities before the board to do so. What he did was within 21 days of the Supreme Court deciding St. Cyr, he went to the board and said, please reconsider my case under St. Cyr, and the board properly decided that it didn't apply. That case is not before this court, but it does show his ability to know the status of the law and to represent himself. And again, I don't think, I know it seems harsh, but the point is he still has remedies.
Well, are you saying that if he were to file a petition tomorrow before the BIA to reopen based upon the accurate conviction record, that the BIA would entertain that, or would the BIA dismiss that as a repetitive petition that it didn't need to think about?
Well, I can't speak for my client. It could take it. The INS could join in it and say, yes, there is a miscarriage of justice, but you have to give my client the opportunity.
There's a possibility
of
taking it, though there's no absolute foreclosure.
There's no absolute foreclosure, and if it were denied, he'd have the opportunity. Then he would have the opportunity to come back here.
It seems so unattractive for the INS to be saying, we get to do whatever we want to, no matter how inaccurate the information, especially in light of all the recent events we've been watching these last few months.
But there's a process in place. And he's taken advantage of the process and not pointed out the error. I mean, at some point you have to look at the volume that they're considering. Everybody comes in and says, well, I didn't really do it.
Well, of course, but then some people actually come back with some
that. But he hasn't done it.
Sometimes the process works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, Muhammad Atta got his visa. I don't think that's an example of the process working.
I agree, and it was huge embarrassment for all of my clients. But the point is, he's had two opportunities to do it. He didn't have to come here and ask you to do it for him. And at some point, we get into prudential exhaustion as well as statutory exhaustion, and he has violated both. Again, it is up to him. It is really, with all due respect, not up to the court to remand. It is up to, because the board has committed no error. He has had his opportunities. He has been deprived of no due process. You cannot say, I have been ineffectively represented by counsel when you are pro se. And he's been pro se twice. Ms. King has done a remarkable job, and I have to compliment her. He's very lucky to have her before this court. But you cannot, no one can overcome these jurisdictional hurdles. Obviously, you disagree.
No.
But they are major, and there's a reason that these processes are in place.
and he is obviously aware of the status of the law. Within 21 days of St. Cyr, he files a motion to reopen asking for St. Cyr, and then doesn't seek review of it.
Is he in custody right now?
I believe so.
Did you know?
No, he's been released?
Do you want to address
it? I'm sorry, I get the paper record.
Did we want to address?
Any issues, any other issues on the merits? I mean, you know, do you want to get...
I was very interested in your, you know, in the government's view of AIDS in Africa.
Well, the...
every day you can open up the newspaper and see... Maybe I can take judicial notice of AIDS drug access still poor in Africa.
May I point, direct the court's attention to page 411 of the administrative record where it says that all of the... Any person who's in custody in Nigeria for any reason, if they have AIDS, they're being released. Also, they're all being tested. The reason is for, so that people can die or be treated in dignity. I think the real reason is they want to avoid infection of other inmates. But it was mentioned at the hearing, and it is on page 411. But the point is, that doesn't entitle him to release. That doesn't make him eligible for asylum. Unless he can show that it's torture, it doesn't make him eligible. Well, that's a whole other story, but it doesn't make him eligible. Unless you can show that the government is trying to torture them, I think this is record evidence to the contrary. They're trying to deal with the situation in a humane manner, and it is a directive that just because a person may not be able to get the treatment in another country that he can get here does not mean that he is eligible for asylum or withholding. I mean, that's not sufficient. You have to show that the group has been targeted and the government is contributing. And they may not be as advanced in Nigeria, but they are trying to grapple with the problem, and I think the record evidence shows that. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. King.
I have just 2 points on rebuttal. The first is the with regard to the conviction cover sheet, and the second is with regard to the status of people with AIDS in Nigeria. Regarding the first point, when my clerk went to the clerk of the circuit court to get the conviction cover sheet, it was given the entire 4-page document. It was not given one cover sheet, and the immigration judge expressly recognized that all he had in front of him was a cover sheet. He expressly recognized that he did not have the rest of the documents. Regarding the second point, regarding the status of people with AIDS and HIV in Nigeria, counsel, again, illustrates the grave error committed below by the BIA, because the BIA's determination that he was statutorily barred from withholding overshadowed its determination on other issues, such as whether he would be persecuted if returned to Nigeria. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that Nigeria has adopted the policy which was recommended by a committee to release all people in the prisons with HIV or AIDS. There is no evidence in the record that one person has been released from the prison system. There is, however, plenty of evidence in the record to show that people who are in Nigerian prisons do not have access to food, do not have access to potable water, and do not have access to medicine. Mr. Bosetti requires daily medicine of several different types. He will not have access to that in the prison system in Nigeria. And there is a dangerous argument to fall into here, that because we cannot help all of people who suffer with AIDS in Nigeria, AIDS or HIV in Nigeria, we should not help one. Mr. Bosetti has a family here, 2 children who are both United States citizens, and a wife who depends on him to help pay for her medication. This is not a simple civil proceeding where a person is at risk of losing money. This is a proceeding where a man is at risk of losing his family and losing his life. We cannot simply take those factors and elevate procedure above the facts that are evident in this case. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. King. You took this case as an appointment, and you have the deep thanks of the court for taking the appointment and for so vigorously and well arguing the case. And thank you, Ms. Schwartz, as well. And the case will be taken under advisement.